First, so in particular, what I'm going to talk about is the approach that is followed up at AI. And one of the most remarkable developments for the AI group was that we are following an exponential growth rate. We're doubling every year. And in the last 1.5 years or so, we have grown from my single person effort to now 4 people. So Christiane is another postdoc, and then we have 2 new students. We have probably 2 more people coming in the next 3 months or so. And then we also, on some of the code and software issues, we work with Ian Hinder, who's a student of Carsten Lundberg. Now, first, instead of a list of contents, let me tease you with some questions to be answered and to be raised. So some of the questions to be answered are, particularly, why compactification, why hyperloidal, why spherical boundaries, why is our code called Scrumwalker? Are 92 constraints too many? And can we go all three copies? And some of the questions raised without answer are spherical boundaries, but how are we going to do that? How should we solve the constraints? And can we get rid of first order symmetric probabilicity as a base technique of writing the equations? Now, first, some motivational things. I'm going to tell you as isolated systems as a model for sources of gravitational radiation. Okay. So one of the this is trivial stuff, but let me go through it anyway, just to shape the basic setting. So 2 key physics concepts to describe astrophysical as opposed to cosmological processes in GR are the essential independence of the large-scale structure of the universe. So if you want to study neutron star merger, for instance, we don't have to worry about the cosmological constant, hopefully. And then the second thing is that radiation leaves the system in some sense. Okay, so these are 2 basic physical things that we want to model. And it leads to a kind of physical idealization, which is an isolated system. And the rough idea is that the geometry sort of flattens out at large distances. Okay. And then in GR, this quite immediately leads to a problem because many fundamental quantities that we are used to deal with in physics, like mass, angular momentum, what's the emitted, in this case, gravitational radiation, and so on, they cannot be defined unambiguously in any local or quasi-local way, and they only make sense in asymptotic limits. Okay. Now, these issues lead to a mathematical formalization of the whole problem within GR, and that's asymptotically flat spacetimes. Okay. And these can be used to model sources of gravitational radiation. So in these spacetimes, one has a notion of gravitational radiation, of energy decreasing because radiation leaves the system, and so on. And they provide a global picture that I'm going to show and talk about later, a global picture of a spacetime, okay, in which we can do our physics and mathematics. And the idea now is to think of this whole spacetime as the source of gravitational radiation. Now, I'll talk about this more later, but
excuse me for 1 second. Yeah. I'm afraid we didn't turn your microphone.
Was it trying to get away with that? But so there are 3 very different directions toward infinity. Okay, time-like, space-like, and now, and so this is one of the first things we have to be aware of. So for instance, if you talk about asymptotic flatness, in an astrophysical sense, doesn't make any sense in a time-like direction. So time-like direction towards infinity is basically we just sit around and wait a long time, right? And in astrophysics, what that means is, so there will always be certain bodies, stars or black holes or so, that are going to wait with us. And so if we just sit around, space-time is never going to flatten out because there are all these bodies with their gravitational fields. So that doesn't make sense. It does make sense in a space-like direction, okay, and it does make sense in a null direction. Now, which one is more interesting for our immediate interest? Well, so let's ask about observers, okay? So we have sources of gravitational radiation, but then also obviously we have to have observers somewhere. They are situated somehow astronomical distances, so for instance gravitational wave detectors. How do we model them? Well, they look inside toward the source along null rays, obviously, because they measure radiation. And it turns out they're modeled by certain geometric object at null infinity. Okay? This is basically a tautology. What I'm saying is just to remind you, because so null infinity is where radiation goes if you wait for a long time, and this is where observers are to observe it, right? One thing that one has to that is interesting is that these observers are basically in phase with the radiation source, okay? So for instance, if you have an observer that goes out along a space-like direction, that is at a large space-like direction, the further he goes out, the more wave the more wave trains he will are between the source and him, okay? So as you take this limit, you get more and more out of phase with the source. This does not happen if you go to infinity along a null radiation direction, okay? So you can take the limit with a finite phase shift between you and the source. All right. So we have brought in the concept of infinities, okay? Now, as you're all aware, computers are not particularly well suited to treat infinities, and even if nowadays they can spit out values like inf and num, that is not really solving the issue. There are two kind of complementary dreams in numerical relativity how to deal with the fact that one wants to model an infinitely large system. And the first one is we might invent some efficient numerical scheme for systems with boundaries, okay, where we can choose the boundaries sufficiently out far outside to get correct results. That's a very reasonable thing to do. A problem is that we kind of need to control two convergence parameters, the one of this discretization and the one of radius, okay? And moving the cutoff surface toward null infinity is difficult. Because if you work in an uncompactified picture, that means that your laps and your shift are going to infinity. So that's not easy to deal with. And moving it towards spatial infinity does only make limited sense. I mean, the most naive thing is to say, well, we have to put the boundaries bigger and bigger and bigger out, and then that's makes the thing better. But of course, if you just move them further away in a space-like direction and not in a radiation direction, where you also advance time, then you have to resolve more and more waves between you and the source, and that also leads to problems. But it's certainly an approach worth trying. And the other thing is, well, use conformal compactification techniques to basically solve the asymptotics problem at the level of the field equations, okay? And then this will lead to a more complicated system of equations. But we might succeed in treating the resulting systems of equations with a higher efficiency and reliability for the overall approach than what is possible here. So these approaches are either the hyperboloidal approach that I want to talk now, and or CCM. Okay. And of course, the obvious problem here is that the threshold to get running is much higher. Okay. It's somehow steeper. I think so this is the standard approach. This has been followed up by a few people. Which one in the end is going to be more efficient is not clear. And I think one possibility is that certain problems will be dealt with better with one, and certain problems will be better dealt with the other one. So let's look a little bit more detailed into conformal compactification. So the simple picture is we have some physical space-time here, denoted with this black hole icon, and then we rescale the metric, in an appropriate way, and we get this picture that Helmut was talking about earlier of a compactified space-time. So we have scries, we have this black hole here that leads to a singularity. So for instance, we have in this picture we may have a regular I minus, but then I plus is this singular structure that is not really well understood. We have scry, we have spatial infinity with the Cauchy surface here, and we have these hyperboloidal surfaces which cut scry as space-like surfaces. So this basic picture is an old idea, basically due to Penrose. So that, and the idea is that with these conformal techniques, we can use local differential geometry to treat asymptotics. So in my notation, I'm always having all quantities which have tilde are physical quantities, and all quantities which don't have a tilde live in this conformal compactified space. So we rescale with a conformal factor omega, which goes to zero at the boundary, and then the physical region of spacetime are these points where the conformal factor is positive. Okay. So in this way, infinity, which means all the space-like null and time-like infinities, are described by this three-dimensional boundary in the four-dimensional spacetime, which has omega equals zero. Now, a remark on so far it's just a picture, okay? But of course now we have to bring in the equations. So how do we compactify, how we carry over this compactification to the Einstein equations? A first remark is that obviously this cannot be straightforward. So for instance, we can take the vacuum equations, so physical Einstein tensor, and we just insert for the physical metric this compactified quantities, and we just work things out. And then immediately we see that these are singular for omega equals zero. So I'll scribe these quantities are singular. Of course, we can multiply the whole thing with omega squared, but that doesn't really help because the principal part of the partial differential equations, just hidden somewhere here, degenerates if you multiply it by zero. So that is not the way to do it. But then, as I'm going to detail more in a few seconds, conformal compactification has been carried to the level of the field equations by Helmholtz. What you have to do is you have to develop some judicious reformulation of the equations, which are called the conformal field equations, which are regular equations for this conformal metric, for the conformal factor, and certain additional quantities. One of the essential things is that there's no such thing as the conformal field equations, actually. One of the, or maybe the key element that you have to do is you have to bring in the Weyl tensor as an independent variable, because the Weyl tensor simply decodes the fall-off of the gravitational field. And what else you do, there's a lot of freedom, okay? So there are some elements that you have to introduce, but then there's a lot of freedom of what other things you do. There are some standard formulations which have been used for various purposes, but there's a lot of freedom. One thing that one can easily see if one multiplies this by omega squared, that then on scry, if we have a vacuum spacetime, so this term is cancelled, this term is cancelled, this one remains, which is this thing here. And if this is zero, then obviously this boundary scry must consist of null surfaces, at least piecewise. Okay, so that's why scry has a null surface. A few more details about this this null surface that we use to model observers at an infinite distance. So first, it's a piecewise smooth surface. It's generated by null geodesics. The congruence of these geodesics is shear-free, and then there are two connected components with topology S2 cross R, and they are scry plus and scry minus. You might introduce more components, okay? Just as you do is in this standard kind of puncture approach, if you want to model topological effects, which model black holes, you can always introduce more infinities, okay? So like you can introduce more punctures to model black holes, you could introduce extra scries to create some topological effect that models a black hole. And then we see that there is quite a bit of structure here. So we have these null geodesics, which give rise to a certain structure. We know that it's shear-free. This is one of the motivations that I will use later to argue that if one wants to treat this problem, one should try to include scry manifestly and make these structures manifest in the numerical treatment, which means you basically have to put your boundary at scry. Okay. Now, if one takes appropriate limits in this compactified spacetime of physical observers, of time-like physical geodesics, then one sees that increasingly distant geodesics of physical geodesic observers converge to non-geodesic generators of Scry, and then their proper time converges to bonded time. So this is just an additional comment to see that this very strange null surface structure really represents time-like observers that are just very far away. If we would do something which would first might look simpler, so we compactify at space-like infinity, then quite obviously this is a piling up of waves, because of course, since the speed of light is finite, they can never reach space-like infinity, so they have to pile up before that. And obviously this effect does not happen at Scry, because there the waves leave the space-time through this boundary. Okay. Now, still there's something very strange going on, because let's say practical circumstances, we really want to compute the signal at a gravitational wave detector, let's say from some supermassive black hole merger which happened at high redshift. Now, then this whole idealization is not so easy, because obviously the universe is not asymptotically flat. So this space-time does not, definitely not model the universe as a whole. This can't be true. What we might think of it is something like Scry is far enough away from the black hole, say, that we can treat the radiation linear without making basically an approximation, but it's not so far away that we have to take into account cosmological effects, like the cosmological redshift or something, okay? But of course, so this is just a picture, and unfortunately, there's no mathematical description of how one can make an idealization of the whole process, the source of the gravitational radiation, and how the radiation goes travels through the universe, and combine all these things. So this is just a very heuristic, big picture. Now,
Okay.
I would be very interested in that. Yeah.
Just this Einstein picture of cutting a hole out of a Friedman universe and concentrating all the mass in something in the center that leaves empty space in between. So you have a spatial solution that matches onto the present.
Okay.
And you could take that as an ideal of what you'd like to do once you.
Yeah. Because all the experts in asymptotic flatness also that have said, well, actually, I mean, this is not the whole space-time, so is there any model that describes it? No, this is complicated, we don't know what to do. We don't want to know anything about it.
It would require some kind of two-scale theory to match it.
So, but this is something very important to bear in mind. So you should not think of this asymptotic flat space-time as the whole universe. This is complete nonsense. Okay. Now, initially I had this slide which would just state these conformophile equations, and then I said this is maybe a little bit shocking. And one thing that is not helpful for the whole approach is making a mystery out of things. So I'll try to give you a very, very, very brief derivation of where these equations come from. Okay. So the first thing is that, well, of course, there are many, many ways to derive it, but I just give you one thing that I find simple and short. So you start by splitting the Riemann tensor into the trace-free and the trace parts, okay? You define the trace-free Ricci, and then you define a rescaled Weyl tensor in this way, and of course, the way you rescale here is basically motivated by peeling, okay? And then so the first thing that you can do is now you apply the standard Einstein equations to this new setting, and you can set, for instance, sort of we are for the moment all vacuum Einstein equations, okay? Although you don't need vacuum, this is just a simplification. You can do it with method, it just gets a little bit more messy. So the first thing you can try now is to set the four-dimensional Ricci scalar and Ricci tensor to zero. You obtain this equation and this equation. This equation, you see, actually, looks strange, because you still, so this is the principal part, and you still have an omega here in front. So this is still degenerate. But you can see afterwards, if you have derived all your equations, that if this equation holds at any one point in the space-time, then by virtue of the other equations, it holds everywhere. So you actually don't really need this equation, okay? So this equation now is an equation basically for omega. It comes from the Ricci tensor, but now So here we use the straightforward Einstein equations, but obviously this is not enough because we just here have something like an equation for omega and actually too many equations for just this one variable. So we need more equations. Another one you get by taking three derivatives of the conformal factor and commuting, and you get an equation for the Laplacian of this conformal factor, which is a somehow strange equation. It turns out that it's needed later. But still, we don't have any equations for these curvature variables. We don't have equations for the metric. So where do these come from? Next, we use this identity which defines the wild tensor, okay, the standard identity. And we can view this as an equation for the metric, okay? But now we have brought in this variable for the wild tensor, so we still need equations for this, and we also need equations for the Ricci, okay? And for those, then the natural candidate where to search for equations are, of course, the Bianchi identities, and they do, in fact, imply this equation and this equation. Now, we actually don't want an equation for the wild tensor, but we want one for this rescaled quantity, but what we can use is that the wild is actually a conformal invariant, so it satisfies this equation. Then it's not hard to derive a funny identity, some kind of modified conformal invariance for the derivative of this wild tensor, so that the standard Bianchi thing transforms this thing where we have taken out the conformal factor, and so if this is zero, this thing is zero, and we can use this as another equation. And if we dig a little bit more into the Bianchi identities, then we can also find an equation for this trace to Ricci tensor. Okay, so now we have some equations, and so for any solution, so we have as variables, now we have the metric, we have the trace to Ricci tensor, we have this rescaled Bianchi tensor, and then we have the conformal factor. Then it turns out that R, which we don't have an equation for, is the Ricci scalar. R hat is the trace to Ricci tensor, and this quantity is the wild tensor of this of the four metric. Okay, the fact that we don't have an equation for this quantity means that this is basically the way we it's a gauge quantity. Okay, we have an equation for the conformal factor, and there must be some conformal rescaling freedom somewhere in the equations. Okay, because essentially the conformal factor, or part of it, has to be gauge, okay? And since we have an equation for omega, this freedom has to pop out somewhere else. And the way things are set up is hidden in this Ricci scalar of the compactified spacetime, okay? So that somehow encodes your conformal freedom. And now you can do a standard 3+1 split. If you want to stick to symmetric hyperbolicity, you actually end up with 57 variables. So you have the standard ones, metric, extrinsic curvature, Christoffel, and then certain split quantities of these curvature quantities which have been introduced, like the electric magnetic part of the wild tensor, and then the conformal factor and certain derivatives of it. Okay, but important is that there's a lot of freedom. As long as you have your conformal factor and the electric and magnetic part of the wild tensor or some other thing that represents the wild tensor as independent variables, there's a lot of things you can do. So you don't have to stick to symmetric hyperbolicity. You can choose all kinds of other variables. You could do something like BSSN or whatever you choose. You have the same freedom, basically, as you have in the standard way. So again, this is mainly a slide for completeness so that you can look at it afterwards when it's on the web. The whole 3+1 business is really business as usual, okay? Because so you have some covariant equations on some manifold. You can actually think of these equations basically as the standard Einstein equations with some kind of very strange matter field. And 3+1 decomposition proceeds in the standard way. There's one thing that one maybe should mention. If you look at the components of the physical metric and the physical extrinsic curvature, then of course in these compactified coordinates they diverge. Okay. If you look at the coordinate independent trace of the extrinsic curvature, this can actually be assumed regular everywhere. So there's a simple transformation law for the extrinsic curvature. And then it turns out, for instance, that at scry, the physical trace of the extrinsic curvature is just minus 3 omega 0, where omega 0 is basically is omega dot, okay, the time derivative of this conformal factor. Since the conformal factor is essentially a gauge quantity, this means that the value of the physical trace of the extrinsic curvature is also essentially its gauge. The only thing which is fixed is its sign. So you can convince yourself that if square plus is an ingoing null surface, then this means that the sign of this is positive. Okay. So any surface which has trace k, the limit of trace k as you go far out, positive, okay, in the physical picture, is one of these hyperboloidal hypersurfaces. So these are the generic space-like hypersurfaces that cross scry. These are exactly those which have the limit trace k goes to some positive constant. In the physical picture, they are obviously asymptotically now with respect to the physical metric, and in some way they are analogous to the standard hyperboloids in Minkowski space. So if you look at one of those, they have trace k equals 3 or something. So these are the standard simple examples.
Now, in your convention, are the standard hyperboloids in Minkowski space positive k?
So there are different conventions in mine. The standard ones that bend up are positive k. I like this convention very much because it means, so this sign of the extrinsic curvature means that if you have expansion, extrinsic curvature is positive. I think it's quite unfortunate that usually in numerical relativity you don't have the other one, where expansion is negative extrinsic curvature, and it's very confusing. You're in numerical spacetime, and there are certain qualitative features which you should always be aware of. And I think one is your metric expanding or is it collapsing? And if this sign is like it's usually used, it's very confusing. So lots of blah, blah, hyperboloidal. The essential idea is if you go further out in space, you also have to go to later times to follow the radiation. Okay? This is the crux of the whole thing. And the simplest way to do that, of course, is to use null surfaces. And if you want to have somewhat more freedom, for instance, to avoid caustics, then your choice is hyperboloidal surfaces. Now, as a first scare, these are all the constraint equations as they come out of the 3 plus 1 split. They're actually, so if you split this into components, it is 92. I have forgotten 2, and you can read this. They just didn't fit on the transparencies. But if you can't, it is 92 constraints. So the obvious question is, are we trapped by too many equations? Okay. Now,
so I say, if you perform the transform the usual ADM constraint equations and multiply a few by factors of omega, you get the same difficulty of omega is multiplying the principal parts. But does that not happen in your formulation of the constraints? I mean, you somehow work around that, or do you see what I mean?
No. If you do, so you introduce these equations as I introduced, okay, and you do a straightforward 3 plus 1 split of these equations. So the equations are regular, completely regular. You do the 3 plus, and then you get regular equations. But of course, the ways you have set things up with all these extra variables, you actually get many more equations than you have variables. So now you have to sort out which ones are actually the independent ones and so on.
Perhaps what leads is asking is this problem that you have the initial data that you have the Yamal equation that goes similar.
So the problem now is actually which ones are the independent variables that has only been sorted out recently. Okay? But of course to set up a constraint solver that's not enough. You have to really get an elliptic problem. Okay? How to get an elliptic problem has been solved for the case where you have omega equals 1, but not for the general case with omega. So we don't know how to solve these constraints. But what one can do is, as I will just briefly mention later, you basically you can first solve the part of the constraints in physical space, then you get this degenerate equations, and then you get the other, you get the other ones later by algebra. That's an indirect approach where you have to deal with a degenerate equation, and to get the other ones you have to divide by the conformal factor, which is zero. So you have a very kind of ill-conditioned problem.
Right. So it's practically a problem, but it
right.
is slightly off.
Yeah, right. I'll talk a little bit about it later.
Yeah.
First thing, analyze the situation, okay? So many questions. Don't get nervous.
Is that you?
No.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. So some steps toward simplification. The first step toward simplification. Constraints. Just split into the independent components first. Unfortunately, this has only been done recently. So, I mean, even if you're not interested in solving the constraints, just in monitoring the constraints, it's obvious that you don't want to monitor 92 quantities, okay? It's slightly confusing. You first have to split into the independent ones. And then evolution equations, one of the first things that you can try to do is look for potential feedback terms that could give you instabilities. And just get a feeling if there are any that look dangerous. And then there are some things that you can do in general. So for instance, obviously, first, look at the case where omega equals 1. There's still a lot of structure in these equations. They're still complicated. And they already have new features as compared to the standard formulations which are used in numerical relativity because they have the inclusion of these curvature variables. And that already leads to some subtleties which have to be understood and which has to, which one has to cope with. And then, of course, you can always look at cases with symmetry. Now, these are the evolution equations, and just to point out one of the features as these equations are written. So, for instance, this is the standard k dot equation, okay? But the nonlinear part where the extrinsic curvature appears has changed. So for instance, usually there are two terms with the extrinsic curvature. There's just one term now, trace k times extrinsic curvature. And this term also appears in the standard equation, but with a flipped sign, okay? So we have eliminated one term, we have flipped the sign, okay? That's important because, for instance, if you now look at your constraint evolution equations, also that means that somewhere there's a sign flipped. So for instance, for the propagation equation of the Hamiltonian constraint. So for instance, if you look at the, as Vince has pointed out, if you look at the constraint equation for the Hamiltonian constraint in the standard ADM or BSSN equations, if you have trace k equals positive, some positive constant, like we have here for these hyperboloidal surfaces, you would assume that your constraints dampen out. Okay, so this looks, it's good news. But here we have flipped the sign, okay? That means that they are, there will be some tendency to blow up.
Is there another unpleasant sign flip in the fact that minus 2 omega E has a reachy? E has a reachy.
Yeah, right.
And doesn't that force you to flip the sign in front of reachy in the ABM equation?
Well, yeah, so but there are certain, yeah. So this has basically eliminated the reachy, okay? The fact that we still have this term, which looks like a reachy like term, is because we demanded that our equations are symmetric hyperbolic, so that's we added this term back in, along with some other terms, okay? So if we would not demand that the equations are symmetric hyperbolic, we might even forget this term and might even achieve ODEs, okay? This term is just there to keep symmetric hyperbolicity. Many of the derivative terms that we have here are just there because they have the overall system symmetric hyperbolic.
Do you evolve these equations directly, or do you put in a lapse and shift and evolve the equation? Time derivative of stuff is equal to lapse times Li n plus Li beta of stuff.
We make the splitting. We work with the densitized lapse and the shift, and we do the splitting. So this is just a condensed.
To get deterministic evolution, must have some coordinate gauge fixing the issue. Are you going to talk about those?
Yeah, very briefly. So we use so the standard picture is you use the densitized slabs to make everything symmetric hyperbolic, and then you use some fixed description for this free function, some function of the coordinates. Okay, and what I would argue is that this is usually not a very good idea, and in this approach is particularly not a good idea. You have to do something more clever.
Do you know how to put on coordinates that would correspond to bond effect coordinates?
No, but I want to find out. But this is really an important issue, I think. But I mentioned that. Anyway, so what I wanted to mention is, so here we have this term here, and it has a flipped sign, which leads to some unexpected behavior. And if you look at the evolution equations for the electric and magnetic part of the wild tensor, and you look for similar terms which could cause feedbacks, then here they are, okay? And they have the opposite sign. So that means if you have a trace K which is big, for instance, which you're easily ending up with in this thing, then you have to expect a different kind of feedback for this one and for this equation, okay? Which is not good. On the other hand, of course, your trace K is essentially just gauge. You could also make it zero. That would not correspond to having maximal slices in the physical because you're in a different spacetime. So there are lots and lots of subtleties here. Now, after this first glimpse of the equations and the complications, let us briefly get an overview of what is the actual task that we want to perform here. And in principle, of course, in the long term, it is to create an approach to numerical relativity which is at least as flexible as the traditional Cauchy approach. It is a Cauchy approach. It just has some extra handles to turn. And as free as from ambiguities, which do arise from trying to approximate the global nature of the problem, as is the characteristic approach. The characteristic approach, its strength is it doesn't have these ambiguities, okay? And it is very simple. It is very inflexible. That's what is the extra safety that makes it quite stable. And the question is, can we create an approach which has the same benefits, but is more flexible? Now, what one has to do? Well, first of all, certainly a lot of work has to go in some kind of general computational framework of some sort, which is needed. And then you need detailed algorithms. Often this means including new analytical results and software modules for the following things. So certainly construction of initial data on these hyperbolic surfaces, treatment of grid boundaries, time evolution, including the choice of gauge, where now you have, in some sense, this is very similar to the standard problem, but you also have new things, new freedom, and you have to cope with it somehow. And then the extraction of physics and computation of gravitational wave information and so on. In principle, since you have access to null infinity, if you can do all these things and you implement them in a stable way, you're done, okay? Which is not the case for the standard approach. If you have a stable evolution at some, which goes up to a finite radius, you're not done. You have to make sure you really get the real physics up and so on. Here, in principle, if you're stable, you're done. So this was the task. Now we have to get organized. And there, just to get started, I think there are essentially three phases. So first, look at what has been done and try to learn from that first phase. The second phase is redesign the overall approach, how the thing is laid out, how you plan to do things. Build up a group, because this is going to be necessary to cover at least some of the issues that arise. And build up a general framework in which you can work. And once you have done this, then you can try to start systematically work out the details of at least the most urgent open issues, which are find suitable gauges. So for instance, at the moment, we don't know what's a good gauge to evolve Schwarzschild in, okay? Work out a boundary treatment and obtain suitable initial data. And then, so this is the current stage. So now it looks kind of like this. There's a plan. Can set it on. That's how to do it. So first, look back on history. A lot of time has been spent. I mean, there's a lot of history about this thing. A lot of code has been written. Lots of results are there. Peter Yerko is going to be here later at this workshop, I think. Marsha Weaver, Florian Siebel. I spent quite a bit of time on working with the codes that Hübner and Marsha have developed. There are two papers where I describe some of this. So if you want to get an overview of the history and how the standard approach has been laid out, I could recommend these two. The most often shown picture to summarize previous things is this one, which I like to call the infinity and beyond picture. And what it shows is null generators, the null generators of Scry at a late time for a 3D evolution without continuous symmetries. And then they focus here at this point, which is I plus, and then they defocus again in this bigger conformal spacetime. Okay. So in this calculation, this involves some non-trivial big data. It verifies that there's a regular point I plus, which is resolved, which is well resolved here. But then, of course, so there are lots of this is a nice picture. There are lots of open issues. In particular, it seems that one has picked up a gauge in this case, which makes manifest the shear freeness of the of Scry. And so this is with a small but non-zero amplitude, and Scry remains a perfect sphere throughout the evolution, even through high constraint violations and in particular, these points meet at exactly time one, which is the same time you get for the amperturb Minkowski evolution. So that one has to chosen here a very, very particular gauge, which makes this picture for the paths of the generators very accurate, even though the evolution in the inside spacetime is not that accurate.
What was the data from this?
So basically something like a Brill wave, okay, with some small amplitude. It's not the same answer as a Brill wave, but something like this, I think. Okay. So here actually it shows from the same evolution. So this is one space axis. This is time. So you see the initial. So this is some physical curvature invariant I here. This is Scry. So you see the initial perturbation due to the radiation. You see that the radiation leaves the grid actually very, very fast. So there's a small pulse without basically nonlinear interaction, just spreads out immediately. And I have done lots of work to try, so see what happens if you make the amplitude bigger. And then there are all kinds of issues which arise where you can improve somehow, but not that much again. Now, let me talk a little bit about the most simple case, which is Minkowski, which in this picture is already somewhat non-trivial. Okay. There are three standard ways of compactifying Minkowski spacetime. I call them static and pseudostatic. There are two ways to do it in a pseudostatic way. And pseudostatic means that all of your variables are time independent except the conformal factor. Okay. Now, the simplest way to do it is you make a mapping from Minkowski space time into part of Minkowski space time. Okay, so you write your conformal compactified line element is just a Minkowski space time, and you write it as a conformal rescaling of again Minkowski space time. And this is very simple to work out. You write your conformal factor, and you write your conformal, you write your coordinate transformation. This is a simple exercise. Somewhat more complicated, but actually the standard picture, which I call the textbook picture, okay, is you map into part of the Einstein static universe. So this is the Wald and whatever textbook standard picture. And then the conformal rescaling looks like this. So pseudostatic is because, so for instance, you see that here, the conformal factor is a function of space and time, okay? slightly. But your metric is and the extrinsic curvature and all the other curvature variables and everything else is stationary. Okay. So this omega doesn't really belong.
Here your capital coordinates are the physical ones. Is that?
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Okay. But then there's another way. So here I wrote again the conformal factor and the coordinate transformation. So this is a little bit more complicated. And the somehow a more interesting case actually is the static case. So you can write a very simple static metric, which is now compactified. It has a shift, however. So I wrote here the conformal factor, the Ricci scalar, and Dreyer's K, for instance. So these are all time independent. And with these choices, you get a completely stationary solution. So basically what you do is you take a hyperboloid in Minkowski space and you just push it up with the Keeling vector. Okay? There's a simple procedure, and that gives you a completely stationary space-time.
The third one gives you both scribes? The first two, you get both of the scribes
This is one scribe. Yeah. So this is a picture which is somehow more closer to the astrophysical picture. Here is there is no point I plus anymore. So time like infinity is pushed away to infinity. Okay. And the interesting question. So for numerical purposes, of course, the interesting question is, can we make this stable? These evolutions, of course. The physical spacetime only lasts from t equals 0 to t equals 1. And even if you have a growing mode, it may not be that dangerous, because by t equals 1, it's over. Okay. That is not an argument why this has to work, because exponential modes can grow quite fast. Okay, and it turns out they actually do. But by t equals 1, they haven't killed you yet. But here, there's a very simple setup. A static spacetime, can we evolve this in a stable way? Now, here, unfortunately, the axis labeling is too small. So these are components of curvature invariants. Okay, at particular grid points, we follow that at a grid point at the center, and a grid point which is close to the boundary, which is the dashed here, and we see roughly there is. So what is actually the left and the right? So this is I and this is j. Right? So there is roughly exponential decay of the curvature, okay? So that's good news. Initially, we had some error because we got the data by finite differencing, so it's not exactly Minkowski space, but there's some error, and the curvature invariants are not exactly 0, but 10 to the minus 10 or whatever. And you have something like exponential decay, okay? So that looks good. However, if you look at the metric, and again, so this is the x-axis and this is time. So this is linear plot and this is an logarithmic. You see exponential growth, okay? And it's not high frequency, but it's a kind of bulk exponential growth. So where did this come from? Well, the most likely explanation is that because for instance, the equation to evolve the extrinsic curvature and the equation to evolve the wild tensor, they just have feedback terms with the opposite sign. And in this time direction, one has a damping term and the other has an exponential growth term. And so the time at which this blows up here is about 5. Okay, so at a very relatively short time scale, this blows up.
Rule out gauge effect? I'm sure it's not gauge.
Well, in a way, of course, it is gauge. Okay. So, we could also have chosen a different gauge, a different conformal gauge. For instance, we could have chosen omega equals 1, okay? And of course, there wouldn't have been any problem. And if you choose the gauges of the first two examples, very compactified in a time of t equals 1, there's also no real problem, okay? So if you want to study, for instance, Minkowski or a weak field on Minkowski, the best thing you can do is this compactification where you compactify in finite time, okay, The radiation goes out very fast, soon it's over. There is no real issue with exponential growth, and it's perfect. It's the best way you can do, okay? But if you're now thinking of, well, we want to model something which is going to last for a long time, like a black hole, and it rings down for 100 m and something like that, okay? Then the thing is interesting. Can you come up with a, for instance, a gauge that mimics that somehow, that leads to a completely stationary spacetime, and can you evolve that in a stable way? And so this is a simple example of how to do this, and it's actually not stable.
Yeah.
No. That's one of the obvious things to do, but no. Certainly the thing is that you have a lot of freedom in this conformal gauge. So for instance, you could choose one where trace k is zero, for instance, and then many other things. Okay. So a few of the lessons learned is you have a constraint violating instability, which seems to appear on the continuum level. But of course, we know that we really have to solve all the Einstein equations everywhere in the grid. And that will mean a modification of the boundary treatment, and then maybe changing the equations or gauge or both. Okay. Boundary treatment here is important because, so one simple thing that you can do is you can try to see, does this constraint relation come from the boundary? Okay. So you move the boundaries further away, for instance, or do other things. It doesn't have any effect. But, of course, these boundaries are in the unphysical region, and the way you set up things, the constraints are actually violated outside of scry. In this whole unphysical region, you have constraint violation. So that the fact that you move the boundaries further away doesn't really mean much, because as soon as you're outside of this sphere, r equals 1, which is scry, you have constraint violations that are going to propagate in, of course. And there's no way to eliminate them unless you really solve the constraints everywhere, which is not known how to do it, or you just compute up the scry, and you just throw away all this garbage which is out there. So if you don't do this, basically, if you not either throw out everything which is outside of scry, or you really solve the constraints everywhere, there's no way to make any of these calculations really conclusive, because you always have to drill with these strange problems of spillover from outside and so on. Another one is that, so this plain densitized labs idea where you use the densitized labs to make things symmetric hyperbolic and then you just specify some function as function of the coordinates is very dangerous, in particular for this conformal setup. Because, for instance, one thing that is quite typical in the answers, standard kind of answers that you can use, is that the metric, the conformal metric, will have some kind of minimum at scry, and then it grows again. Okay. And that means if you use something like this, where the lapse is faster, where the determinant of the metric is bigger, typically what will result is that the metric outside of scry starts to evolve much faster than inside. But actually, outside is just garbage, and just this doesn't really work. So we certainly like a fully working implementation of the constraint solver. We have a constraint solver that works well to solve this Riemann equation. But then the problem of getting the other variables and so on, this is not solved. What is very typical for all these compactified approaches is that suddenly things happen faster, okay? And there's less room for cheating. For instance, by factoring out the asymptotic fall-off, now you apply your boundaries in a strong field region, okay? If you do it in a standard approach and you apply your boundaries at, I don't know, 50 m, say, you manage to do that, you apply them in a region where the field is very weak, and you may get away with some cheating, for a while at least. Okay, if in this setup you're not getting away with cheating, because none of the fields is weak, because this is exactly what you have factored out. And also, the equations are certainly complicated enough that you're doing much better if you do as much as possible with computer algebra. And then also, so we decided we want. There's certainly a lot of experiment going to be needed, trying out different things. So we want something where we can very flexibly add different modules that will run in 3D. And so we decided to go with calculus.
You go to Sony PlayStation where you want to run.
ask Dennis about the PlayStation. So I plan this interlude talking about gear to help sending this problem, but since there's no time, I think I skip this whole thing. Just show you that there was some stuff I had here. Let me just extract one line maybe. So my philosophy is if you want to use computer algebra to, for instance, generate code at the end, so process equations and generate code, one thing that is very, very important is, I think, try to work with abstract indices as far as possible, because otherwise you end up in a mess. And then try to produce really readable code at all levels. So for instance, we stayed away from all kind of optimizers which completely scramble up the code, because we leave that to the C or whatever optimizer. Even if it's computer algebra generated, try to make it readable. Okay, so back to the project, back to more or less conclusions. Can I overdraw for maybe 5 minutes or so?
Sure.
Okay. What I will try to convince you now is some kind of paradigm shift. So first I have to tell you what the traditional paradigm is of doing this conformal thing, and it's summed up by this picture. It's based on the extended hyperboloidal initial value problem. Extended means that your hyperboloidal surfaces go outside of Scry. Okay? So Scry is a sphere, and then you go outside to make your grid cubic, okay? And then also compactification in time. And then typically your Scry plus, which is described by where omega, which is an evolution variable, is zero, it moves through the grid. And typically it will contract, okay, like this. And then you will always have your constraints violated outside of Scry plus, unless you find new ways of solving your equations. And the spillover in error and constraint violations hope to converge away. If you call this convergent, that's what it should do. However, of course, since we basically have no control over the portion of space-time that you have here, in particular about the constraint violation, it's easy to see, and actually, so that does happen, that you usually get singularities forming in this region. So even when this may be fine, you can get singularities forming here, and if there's a singularity forming here, and this thing is not regular anymore, then this whole idea of convergence and the spillover converging away is annihilated, of course. That only works if everything stays smooth and nice and regular. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. And then you certainly aim at the global structure. So you would certainly not do excision because you really want to get the whole picture.
What about excision outside Scry?
So this is the kind of new paradigm that I think one should follow instead. So first, you focus on astrophysical scenarios, and what that means in this context is you don't compactify in time, okay? You avoid space-time regions of uncontrollable constraint violation, and that means Scry is the limit. So you just go to Scry, you excise everything which is outside, and so that requires you to have some spherical boundary at Scry. You have to find a shift which fixes Scry at a fixed location. This is, in principle, quite easy to do. However, you must make this prescription compatible with the appositeness, and that's not so clear how to do it in our formulation. In the tetrad formulation that Jörg uses, that is not a problem. Certainly a question is, can we come close, or can we formulate boundary conditions here, for instance, that put us into a bonded gauge? That's a very important question, because that would be the natural gauge at Scry. Most of the gauge issues that arise, we can try to mimic what happened in the uncompactified case where there's a lot of experience, but it's not clear how we handle this conformal gauge. There's very little experience with that. An interesting thing is certainly for us to excise the singularities and otherwise, I mean, follow very much the standard setup that is
so used. So you are going to exercise inside the black hole?
Well, I mean, we are not doing it now, but I'm just telling you what the paradigm is of what we would like to do, and this is certainly it. Okay, so where are we now? We have seen some of the problems. We have very roughly chosen a route. We have some of the tools in place. So basically, we are here. That's where we want to go. The first thing now that to do is to do some acclimatization hikes, things that are not going to solve your problem, but just to get your experience to the altitude. So for instance, certain toy problems are interesting. One thing that I find interesting, for instance, is Maxwell on a flat background. So the Maxwell equations are very similar to the equations for the wild tensor, same structure. If you do Maxwell on a flat background but in non-standard coordinates, you get this constraint propagation equation, for instance. You immediately see if trace k has the wrong sign, you're in deep trouble, and this is a completely linear equation, and this is without horizons or anything.
You can make that go away if you say the ender. That's a kind of kinematical thing.
Yeah, sure. No, this is just a simple model for the structure of the propagation equation for E and B, which maybe one also can change. I mean, there's a lot of freedom that you can do. There are certain steps that we have to go through. I organize them in camps because if you climb a big mountain, camps are the things where there's no logical order. You go from one to the next one, but you often go back to one. You have this kind of iterative loops that is close to how we work. And the thing that we're most concerned with now is try to put periodic boundary conditions in 3D. There are lots of issues go away, and there are lots of experiments that one can do in this setting. Of course, the obvious next thing is to do 1D with a boundary. There are lots of things that are known, for instance, particular issues like gauges and very important thing that is completely unclear how to do it now is stable evolution of Schwarzschild, just in 1D, for instance. This would be a big achievement. Let me try to skip most of the other details because of time. We just finish with the conclusions. So first, conclusion is there's certainly a long way to go, okay? And second conclusion, doesn't come up, that it could be worth it.
Questions?
Worth. I have a kind of model for your static compactification of an enthalpy workout for Schwarzschild.
So this is certainly something interesting. Yeah.
Using CMC.
So I think this is certainly the way to go for us, and then first try it out in spherical symmetry, and see how we can make this work.
There is maybe one Schwarzschild could do without boundaries, and that is the R equals constant surfaces inside the Kruskal upper horizon. They have constant k, and you can make them periodic because they're independent. So you just have these little cylinders with spherical cross sections. You can put periodic boundaries on one, and of course it has to evolve from wherever you started to the singularity or out.
Yeah. Okay. That sounds like something to try. Yeah.
This is sort of a general question. I mean, a lot of the stuff that you said at the beginning of the talk about radiation and the need for scry could have been said about Maxwell's equations and flat space. But, you know, people people who sort of do numerical simulations of Maxwell's equations don't usually worry about these issues and don't say, oh, you know, we need to go to Scry and come up with these equations. So what is the sort of crucial thing that says why it's important to do this in general relativity? I mean, it can't just be radiation, because that's present in Maxwell's equations. What is it that tells us that, you know, this is really a way that we ought to go in relativity?
Well, I mean, if you, certainly I think it depends very much on the problem. So I'm not, for instance, I'm not very familiar with the typical problems that that one does in solving Maxwell's equations. For instance, typical radiation problems of where you have electromagnetic radiation are of a completely different nature, right? Because you don't have, you don't deal with the radiation which is created by bulk movement, but which is more statistical kind of radiation. So usually,
if you were to say to, you know, an electrical engineer designing an antenna, mm-hmm. you know, gee, you want to know the radiation that comes off of this antenna, but radiation, you know, is really a property only of Scry, and so you really ought to run your, you know, antenna analysis in the conformally compactified Minkowski space instead of Minkowski space, the guy would sort of look at you like you were nuts.
Yeah.
Really the question is, well, you know, is the electrical engineer missing something? Should he really be going to Scry? And if not, what is the difference between, you know, the electrical engineer and Scry?
He uses a 1 over R spherical harmonic expansion. Yeah.
But this is my point.
No, he's
using the regular Maxwell's equations on flat space, no. Not the conformal Maxwell's equations.
But for the Maxwell equations.
It makes sense about going radiation, incoming radiation, and local energy, local energy content of whatever is in that surrounding area. But those concepts are not there in GR unless you go.
There are two different features. One is that, except maybe in the antenna problem, the thing you're looking at has wavelengths that are, most of astrophysics, much smaller than the size of the thing you're looking at. But okay, for the antenna, you're doing that. However, outside of your source region, but in the near zone, you can already match to analytic spherical harmonics and YLMs. You have Hinkle functions, you know how to deal with them. So you can impose boundary conditions well inside the first fraction of a wavelength. Nope, you don't have to go out to the wave zone. Secondly, in GR, you have all this backscatter that's coming from the M over R curvature infinity, and if you're really solving the equations, you don't know how to include that in any decent boundary.
Oh, I see. So your answer is that the electrical engineer knows how to do quotient characteristic matching.
They know how to do it inside the first tenth of a wavelength if their antenna is only a tenth of a wavelength.
Okay.
They don't even have to go out to the wave zone.
Okay.
But for us, even out in the wave zone, we're beginning to get some of this backscatter that we don't really know how to handle. It was going to cause problems. It might be small.
That's right. Because it's a linear problem.
Maybe Hank Hills, though, and the same issue, that's the problem variant. And I think that would be a good thing to do, actually. I think the engineer should learn that. I mean, it's so beautiful to write down Maxwell's or Hank Hills equations on this compactified cylinder like Sasha did it. I mean, you would almost convince an engineer that that's the way to.
I guess we should try it.
Yeah, a lot of Yang Mills engineers around.
Okay, may I insist on this philosophical discussion while it's not even philosophical? Let's think about astrophysics and physics if you want. Now, I understand all these motivations for having compactified space time, but then you put one source in your compactifying space-time. Yes, that's far away from reality. So having, you know, handled properly all the backscattering, effectively your source is not isolated, but it's, you know, it's going to be together with many other sources out there which are producing other waves or curvature perturbations. Doesn't that make you feel nervous that you're spending a lot of effort to try to get this right, but then you're not take into account that the space time is not just made of this sort into this compacted.
If it's a standard astrophysical problem, then I think you will always have a collection of sources. I don't know, two neutron stars, and maybe there's some accretion disk somewhere, whatever it is, and it's in a relatively compact region of space-time. Okay, and then there, if they make gravitational radiation, then gravitational radiation is sound, which have a wavelength which is relatively large compared to the system, which makes you have to deal with a relatively larger region of space-time, which is around this couple of sources. And the next solar system, you will not have to worry.
Well, I'm not sure. If I am at Scry, mm-hmm. and I know there is between me and my source, there is a galaxy or something else, a dark matter halo, then do I worry about the fact that the gravitational wave has gone through that?
You worry about this the same way that you have to worry if you do the standard way. I mean, you extract your gravitational wave signal.
No, correct. In the standard way, I know I'm making an error, and I just say, fine. I don't go through the pain of compactifying. One of these on the pain. But I don't worry about compactification mm-hmm. because of that. And I know I'm
okay.
making an error.
Well,
so the point is, if you want to compactify, then losing this term, does it really give you a more accurate solution to your equation?
Well, so what you do is you come up with a mathematical model for your calculation, okay? And this is a mathematical model for the problem of the source and the nonlinear interactions and the radiation that comes out of it, okay? And that's the essential thing of doing numerical relativity with the idea of treating an asymptotically flat spacetime. Even if you do the cutoff thing, you will put boundary conditions that are essentially motivated by the fact that you want to approximate an asymptotically flat spacetime. Okay. Now, if you want to really extract the signal to the detector, you have to take into account cosmological effects like the redshift and I don't know gravitational lensing and all these other things. You have to put this in extra. Okay. And you put it in basically the same way in one or the other. I mean, as I said in the beginning of the talk, I mean, putting this on a more solid footing, okay, how you deal with these very different length scales, I think is a very important issue, but it has not been addressed in the conformal or in the other, and it's the same issue in both, okay? But there was some suggestion of how to do it, and I think this would be really very worthwhile.
Another thing that worked about that same way is the, a long time ago, I think it was NASA, worked out that if you did this two-length scale matching, you have a small black hole mm-hmm. near a big black hole, and you just match at the Scry almost mm-hmm. first mm-hmm. one to the other, then the conditions of matching require that the small black hole topology does it with large. And that was just based on saying, well, I'm not quite at Scry, I want the mm-hmm. curvature far out from the small black hole in its length scale to match the curvature. Large black mm-hmm. hole, small scale, and so that gives you plausible
physical
results. So I think that would be another justification for the standard.
I think one could also say
we don't really need to bother about doing anything more on this. If you get it out to Scry, okay, Scry is going to be 200 wavelengths away from where the source was, and that's so small compared to the distance mm-hmm. of the source to us that it's linear theory from there on to us.
I think, another thing in the same line that one could say, well. And doing this conformal compactification thing is not taking you away from also considering other effects, but it actually makes it possible to start talking about this in an organized fashion. Okay, so it goes so this whole formalism goes in the direction of having some real concrete way of dealing with these questions.
Well, you know, I think also the question of backscatter as well is not really solved by this compactification because that creates. It means that Scry really isn't smooth, for instance.
Oh, does it? Is it strong?
Yeah, it can be. I mean, it depends on the previous what's been happening in the previous history of the source. I mean, if it was initially static at some time just before you're ready to start your calculation, then it's okay. But if it had some long dynamical mm-hmm. history, like say a binary spiral, then it's not okay.
Yeah, so I'm not the expert on these things. I mean, there's a lot of thinking about the smoothness of scribe, what it could mean physically that Helmut is doing, or and other people that work with him.
So, you know, I think in practice, it's, that's not the most, far from the most serious problem with trying to deal with these problems. You know, get an answer for LIGO or something. I mean, you know,
it's, no, but it could give you a way to move the boundaries further out. I mean, the reality is now, because the computational resources that are available to us in 3D, the outer boundaries are being put in the base case, now it's 50M, 100M, that's around the corner. So we got a black hole just 2 blocks from us, and that's not what we have. And so any method that can push the boundaries quite further out would be quite welcome in this one.
No, but it doesn't solve the problem of how you start, say, some initial hyperorbital surface. It doesn't solve the question of what incoming radiation should physically be present on.
No, certainly not. Certainly not. I mean, I think the best it can do is it gives you a different outlook on the problem. And I think, I mean, if you want to discuss these kind of things of what's the physical, what are physical initial data, I don't see a reason why hyperboloidal surfaces are worse than Cauchy ones. Because, I mean, in this whole scribe picture, the scribe is us, right? So that's the observers. And space like infinity is the infinite past. So scribe, I think, has much more physical, that's a much easier physical interpretation than space like infinity. I mean, if you start to talk about space like infinity, that's really a tricky, very tricky issue.
The other issue, you know, to what extent could you get a lot of the same benefits just by taking a hyperorbital slice and more of a conventional 2+1 with, you know, special coordinates that stretch out in the right way?
Well, the problem with hyperboloidal is that they're nice for many reasons. But if you want to do them in the standard way without compactification, then for instance the lamps has to go to infinity. So this is not nice. I mean I don't know, but I would guess if you want to treat this with in any way that makes the whole thing nice and regular and well defined, you're probably going to end up with this in some way or another. But I don't know.
Several things along the lines of what Jim suggested, but see if there's a way to have a kind of conformally regular, more conventional ADM, and so far I haven't come to conclusions which are very satisfying. But I'm not convinced it isn't possible to do something like that, including even the compactification. I mean, you write something like ADM equations for the unphysical metric, but that go all the way to the scribe. I've got some candidate equations that can do that, but I'm not convinced they'll run on.
So what are the variables then? The ADM things plus the conformal factor, just these?
Yeah.
No curvature.
I have to also couple it to the brow
tension components. Yeah, but this is what I said in the talk, right? So you have to include the wild tensor as a variable, and you have to include the conformal factor as a variable. And what else you do is basically your thing. So you can do this in the ADM, BSSN, symmetric hyperbolic, or whatever other fashion, or characteristic, or whatever other fashion you want to put it. The only things which are fixed are you need to evolve your conformal factor, and you need to evolve the bound tensor, and everything else is free.
I mean, I think people have a misimpression that you either do ADM or you do something totally orthogonal to the thing.
Yeah, right.
It's
yeah.
Not really that
No.
It's not really that far removed.
No. Yeah, right. So certainly, I think one thing that should bring that is necessary for once is makes this more practical. Try to make the problem as simple as possible. So, for instance, if one can get rid of symmetric hyperbolicity, symmetric hyperbolicity to make it well posed with something that allows to discard some of the variables and derivatives, that certainly is a very worthwhile thing.
I was thinking more of elliptic hyperbolic, where you can close some other elliptic equations. Have these unpleasant irregularities of scribe, just like you mentioned that the constraints do, or some of the constraints do if you go back to the ADM formalisms. Yeah. I don't know what to say about that.
I think as long as one doesn't go beyond scribe, then I think it's doable.
But even though you have omegas multiplying the principal parts, that's not a tragedy.
Well, I think there are many methods that can deal with that.
Yeah.
You have to be careful, but you can't do it.
Last time I looked at, I remember this,
student of Robert Shane was working with Helen on the constraints.
Right. Adrian Butcher.
Adrian Butcher, yeah, and it was a real mess. Is that, and there wasn't a huge amount of progress. Is that?
Well, so what he did was basically specialized to the omega equals one case, so no compactification.
Right.
And then, so this is by itself is an extremely interesting problem, because what you do is you have to develop an alternative way of solving the standard physical constraints, which is alternative to the usual York procedure.
Right.
That's very nice, because one of the standard problems is, well, how do you encode the physical information and so on?
Right.
And if you have a completely orthogonal approach, so that by itself that's nice. And what he did was basically sort out the independent variables and everything right on an elliptic system, and then prove an existence and a uniqueness for small data, basically.
Okay.
But if you want to carry that over to the full compactified thing, yeah, and he was using asymptotic fall-off things, okay?
Yeah.
But if you want to carry it to the full problem, then you have to deal with boundaries in some way. I mean, you're not going to do it again with asymptotic fall-off. You have to put some boundaries somewhere and deal with the larger system. That's not going to happen for a while, I think.
Have to use Nash-Moser just to get the result he did. I mean, it's very complicated, the
I don't. So, the details, I don't know. I know how to sort it out into independent variables and any basics thing, but the proof, the details of the proof itself, I don't know. I think basically it was implicit function theorem, but more.
But why was he for it? I thought this version of constraints were conformally regular, so why is it necessary to put omega equal to 1 to do what he did?
Well, first you have to sort out what are your independent variables. I mean, what do you specify, and what is then solved by equations? And that's not trivial how to do that. And you have to do quite a lot of gymnastics to figure that out. And then you have to make this system really elliptic. And then you have to find boundary conditions which are somehow consistent to that. And that this is has turned out to be quite hard.
Any other questions? All right, let's thank Sasha again.
Let me just make